The Word of Mouth podcast from NHPR is made possible with support from you, our subscribers.
And from Dartmouth Hitchcock, offering care in 30 locations across northern New England and in your community. Dartmouth Hitchcock is here. Dartmouth-Hitchcock.org.
And from Heinemann, a provider of resources written by real teachers for real classrooms. Heinemann values teachers as decision makers and students as curious learners. Discover the path to lifelong professional learning at Heinemann.com. Heinemann, dedicated to teachers.
About 5 years ago, Sam Pinkasek left New Hampshire and moved to San Diego. Not long after, he had one of those surreal, you're not in Kansas anymore moments.
I went to Target, just like Target, and I'm just walking through the aisle, and I see just sparkling water and stuff like that. Then I get to the next aisle, and it's just liquor bottles in Target. And I was like, to me, that was really strange at first. And I was like, why is that weird to me?
It was strange, of course, because here in New Hampshire, you won't find gin or vodka at Target, or any store for that matter, except for state-run liquor and wine outlets. Where we grow up determines what we think of as normal. Take highway liquor stores. Why not? Sometimes you have to leave your home in order to realize how weird it really is.
I found this list online about what kind of values that New Hampshire's model bar would have, and kind of house rules that they would have for their bartenders and how they would treat their customers. And a lot of them made sense, but some of them just sounded like something that somebody who had never been to a bar ever would say.
For example,
one of my favorite ones was, you shouldn't have happy hour because that encourages drinking in excess. You should have hungry hour and encourage people to eat food.
Yeah.
Seems very strange.
So what was your only New Hampshire question? Just generally.
Basically, just why are liquor laws so weird in New Hampshire?
I'm Virginia Prescott, and this is Word of Mouth. Today, as part of our Only in New Hampshire series, which investigates your questions, we're spending the whole show looking at New Hampshire's liquor laws. Are free drinks illegal? How do local producers get their booze into state-run stores? And what is the alcohol fund? Producer Taylor Quimby's been working pretty hard on these questions and many more. Taylor, how's it going?
It's going good. But before we get started, I kind of wanted to ask you a question, which is, do you think New Hampshire's liquor laws are weird?
I do, especially for the live free or die state, bars closing early. I mean, there's all these kind of things that I hear. I don't actually know if there are laws or not about regulating liquor that seems kind of not market driven.
Yeah, yeah. It's a question that I put to Joseph Malika, who's the chairman of the New Hampshire Liquor Commission. We're going to hear more from him later in the show, but I just wanted to play this first. I asked him, is it weird?
There's always unique circumstances when it comes to liquor laws, but I wouldn't consider New Hampshire liquor laws weird by any stretch of the imagination. I mean, some states have bars open till 4 o'clock in the morning. Some places do drive-through liquor stores where you can or get a margarita to go. Every state is different, so.
At one point I lived in New Orleans, and in Louisiana you could get a drive-through hurricane.
Right, which is weirder. A highway liquor store or a drive-through hurricane?
Well, I mean, he is the chair of the Liquor Commission. He's not going to say we have weird laws.
That is true. Well, either way, I have to say that weird or no, I think it's worth spending some time trying to unravel fact from fiction and really understand how liquor laws impact New Hampshire. Because whether or not you're looking at it from any perspective, as somebody who drinks, as somebody who doesn't, as a business owner, they are really important in one way or another.
It is an honorable mission, but it sounds like you've got it covered. So I'm going to let you take over hosting duties from here, because, the host can't drink on the job.
Sam Pinkasek looks hip enough to hang out at a Brooklyn bar, but he's New Hampshire enough to show up to the NHPR studios in a T-shirt, even though it's below freezing. Maybe he hasn't bought a new jacket since he moved back from San Diego.
The bars out there, I really got into the craft cocktail scene out there because there's a lot to experience. I mean, it's a city. You're going to have a lot more options.
Sam and his wife moved back to the state in May. They bought a house in Mount Vernon. Sam works remotely, so he spends a lot of his days hanging out at a place called Union Coffee Company in Milford, just one town south. They've got craft beers, coffee, bands. A friend of his owns the place.
And I was just talking with my friend there about, wondering if they were going to have cocktails on their menu sometime. And he said, it's complicated. And I was like, that's strange. It seems like a simple question.
There's a funny thing about bars in New Hampshire. Technically, there are none. There are only restaurants. Back after Prohibition ended, when the 21st Amendment was ratified in 1933, states were given a choice. They could choose to continue banning liquor sales entirely. They could allow the sale of alcohol by private stores and companies, or they could take over liquor sales themselves, create a state-run monopoly to oversee operations, and collect taxes. About a third of the country chose that last option, including New Hampshire. Today, we call these states control states. There are 17 total, and they all do things a little differently.
Basically, the federal government says it's still illegal. If a state wants to make it illegal, then everything is mother may I. Everything we do is, you know, what we allow.
This is John Hunt, a 16-term Republican state rep from Cheshire County.
So originally, it was thought that the best thing to do when you have alcohol around is that you should have food. And there has always been a food requirement. So there are no bars in New Hampshire. There's no place that all it does is serve a bar like other states.
In other words, after Prohibition ended, legislators didn't want bars or saloons opening up willy-nilly around the state. So they only gave licenses to restaurants. Eventually, they made a more relaxed license for places that wanted to serve beer and wine. But if you wanted to serve the hard stuff, you had to meet the food requirement. And you still do. Today, 50% of sales have to come from food if you want a full liquor license. Or you've got to sell at least $75,000 worth of food every year. The real question is, in a state known for its live free or die attitude, how has this law survived so long?
I'm just mostly curious what the reason is behind it. You know, just it seems kind of strange to try to make sure that people are drinking responsibly by making sure that they can eat food. While at the same time, you know, if it's New Hampshire, we have liquor stores on our highways. It seems kind of strange to me.
Yeah. In truth, the New Hampshire legislature has carved out dozens of exceptions, special liquor licenses that allow establishments to serve or sell booze without food. There's a special license for hotels, for airports, for vessels and train cars. There's even one for alpine slides, a special license that was passed before any alpine slides had actually been built in the state. If you can't get one of these special licenses, the food requirement applies. For real, sit-down, dining room-style pubs and restaurants, that's not an issue. It's your neighborhood dive bars that wind up feeling the pinch.
There's also another bar called Panouche's or something like that in Nashua that both of these have food that, to me, obviously looks like it's meant to pass a law. Like, it kind of looks like top ramen with, like, some vegetables thrown in, maybe. And it's good and it's cheap, you know? It's like, you know, $4 a dish or something, which is great, you know? Because the bars are awesome. Like, are they selling $75,000 worth of ramen?
What difference does it make whether you get really drunk on wine or beer and no food, or shots of tequila and food? You know, it really kind of makes no sense. It's all the same drug, you know?
Todd Towsley is the owner of Panouche's Bar. Three of them, actually. He's got one in Keene, one in Concord, and one in Nashua.
I never did get the reason why they have it that way, but they still have it on the books.
Todd bought his Keene Bar in 1990. An old neighborhood dive off the main drag. And back then, he made do with just the beer and wine license. But over the years, as more and more restaurants started to pop up, competition forced him to upgrade. He wanted to be able to sell liquor. So he converted an old closet into a kitchen, got a deep fryer, and made up a menu. But Todd told me that didn't really change the basic facts.
Yes, people come in and eat my food, but in reality, for so many years, it was just kind of like a beer hangout place that most people really look at us as a place they want to go and have a few drinks and watch the game. So it doesn't really make us a restaurant just by having a kitchen.
So how does the Liquor Commission feel about it?
I don't get the everyday feeling that the State Liquor Commission is out to enforce this rule particularly heavy. They're more concerned about underage drinking and over-intoxication, which is important to us out in the field as well.
In New Hampshire, the Liquor Commission doesn't make laws. They enforce them. And yes, they do come up with their own guidelines. Joe Malika is chairman of the New Hampshire Liquor Commission.
Now, we don't go in and tell people that, you know, we're not in the business to say what is food. Is a jar of pickled pig's feet and deviled eggs at the end of the bar food? Well, technically it is. and if you meet your requirements, which is something that there's a certain amount of leniency.
One bar owner told me, as long as you make a good faith effort, as long as you look like you're selling food, the Liquor Commission doesn't really care. Another told me that the food requirement is used to put pressure on so-called problem bars that are too rowdy. For example, the now-defunct Club Liquid in Manchester. In 2005, Club Liquid got busted for a few different violations, failing to train employees, over-serving customers, but it was the food requirement that led the Liquor Commission to downgrade Club Liquid's liquor license. Eventually, the place shut down. Eddie Edwards was chief of liquor enforcement at the time.
It seems on the surface like, okay, well, that place appears to be a bar, not a restaurant.
Edwards told me that the Liquor Commission works with establishments for years sometimes to help them meet the requirements before resorting to enforcement. But he's not a big fan of the law either. When he was with the commission, Edwards even recommended the state do away with the food requirement entirely.
A recommendation that we split the categories, that we actually, you know, we're realistic of what's going on, but there's a lot of tug of war there.
In 2001, Representative John Hunt sponsored a bill that would simplify the state's licensing. There are currently more than 50 classifications of retail and on-premise liquor licenses, those special exemptions I mentioned earlier. This bill would have knocked that down to 4. It would have also done away with the food requirement, and in exchange, bars that wanted to serve hard alcohol without grub would have to pay more for their license.
That would be the second time I've tried this. And each time, it was always the Liquor Commission's idea, by the way, and I was sponsoring the bill for the commission that, you know, let's run this up the flag and see what happens.
In public hearings on the bill, one representative asked if it would mean bars didn't have to serve pretzels. The moral argument came up, too. Donald Wharton, then president of Plymouth State College, wrote a letter to the House Ways and Means Committee opposing the bill.
Every college town and many of our city neighborhoods suffer already from the destructive presence of the outlaw bar that serves minors, intoxicated persons, and sends the implicit message that sexual harassment or sexual assault will be tolerated on their premises. Mr. Chairman, this bill will only encourage and proliferate these kinds of socially destructive establishments.
The Liquor Commission testified diplomatically in favor of the bill. Hunt paraphrased their comments with a little more flavor. This legislation, he said, is strongly recommended by the New Hampshire Liquor Commission, who believe that the current laws governing licensing in Title VIII are a complex labyrinth constructed more to accommodate new and evolving businesses than an orderly and efficient licensure structure for businesses selling alcoholic beverages. So what ended up happening with the bill in 2002?
All those bills have died. Yes, they died. They're dead.
Eddie Edwards and Chairman Joe Mollica both told me that one of the reasons the food requirement stays in place is because of all the restaurants who have already had to comply.
Yeah, so my name is Mike Summers. I'm the president and CEO of the New Hampshire Lodging and Restaurant Association.
As far as I can tell, the New Hampshire Lodging and Restaurant Association was technically in favor of the 2002 bill. Their lobbyist was marked in the pro camp on documents about the hearings. Still, Mike explained why restaurants might be in favor of the status quo.
You know, a lot of these guys, because of the food requirement, have already invested a significant amount of time, effort, and resources in the way of kitchen equipment, kitchen staff, inventory for their kitchens, you know, food storage equipment, etc. And when you roll it all up, it's a pretty significant amount of money.
There's a sort of inertia to these old laws. If you change them, it's easier for up-and-comers than it was for the old-timers.
You're essentially going to have a bunch of bars pop up around the state that are going to directly compete with these restaurateurs who have been forced to put in all this equipment and all this capital investment. And, you know, now exactly what do they do without losing that investment?
As it turns out, this isn't a rhetorical argument. Sam, who asked us about the food requirement in the first place, he's actually got some skin in the game.
I love craft cocktails, so I would actually be interested in maybe opening up a tiny cocktail bar in the future, but I don't think I want to go through the trouble of opening up a whole kitchen and restaurant, you know? So for me, that's inhibiting me from opening a business.
I told Todd Towsley at Panucci's about Sam's dilemma. To be a successful entrepreneur, he said, you can't be scared of the rules.
Man, don't be afraid. Just find the rules, make yourself a kitchen, you know, try to do it right and open your cocktail, but don't be afraid. You'll have what you need. Just go for it.
And Sam, if all else fails, you can always get a special license and put your cocktail bar at the top of an alpine slide. Or in a train car. Or in a hotel. Or on an airship. Or in a ballroom. Or in a vessel. Or in a breakfast. This is Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio. I'm Taylor Quimby, filling in for Virginia Prescott for the rest of the show, which is all about New Hampshire's liquor laws and New Hampshire liquor culture. So with that in mind, we're going to be coming up with three Granite State-themed cocktails. And at the end of the show, we're going to have you vote on which is your favorite, by name and recipe anyway. And we are starting off with our budding bartender and the man who helped inspire this whole show, Sam Pankasic, who, as it turns out, when he came into the NHPR studios, had just recently concocted something that is absolutely perfect for this challenge.
I've been really into rum lately, like dark-aged rum, so I have a Dominican... It's a rum from Venezuela, actually. It's really good, kind of an aged, darker rum, and then I kind of made an old-fashioned, but I made it with maple syrup.
Mm.
So, pretty basic, just 2 ounces of the rum, 6 dashes of Angostura bitters, teaspoon of maple syrup. And then, this is the night it snowed, so just like 2 nights ago.
Oh, perfect, yeah.
Took a cup full of fresh snow, and then I took some Meyer lemon slices, squeezed them into the drink, and then poured the drink over the snow. And it was cool watching the snow kind of melt into it, and then I had this cold, like, chilled drink that was actually really good.
Did you name it?
Yeah, I don't have a good name for it. If you can come up with a good one, that'd be amazing.
I don't know.
No yellow snow jokes. It definitely started looking like that at the beginning. I was like, oh no, this is just going to be gross. It's just going to look like you're eating yellow snow.
Yeah.
But then it melted and it was fine. So it's a close call though.
We're calling this one the Manchattan. When we come back, a look at the local liquor movement. Think craft beer, but for spirits. I'll find out exactly what happens at a distillery's test kitchen.
Okay. What do you think?
Ooh, it's like drinking perfumes. That's when Word of Mouth continues. This is Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio. I'm Taylor Quimby, stepping in for Virginia Prescott. Today, we're taking a hard look at New Hampshire's liquor laws, what makes them different from other states, why are they set up the way they are, and we're taking your questions about New Hampshire liquor laws. We got this one through Facebook.
Hi, this is Jonathan from Manchester, and I wanted to know what the barrier of entry looked like for local brewers and distillers to get their products into state liquor stores. Thanks.
To answer this question, Virginia and I took a trip up to Tamworth Distillery, one of just a handful of liquor producers here in New Hampshire. It was a lovely snowy morning as we curved around Route 113 and the Ossipee Range. This pristine landscape is where Tamworth sources its water from a deep aquifer.
Hello. Hello. How are you?
Welcome.
Housed on top of what used to be the Tamworth Inn, the retail space of the distillery has tall, barn-like ceilings. It's decked out with colorful bottles, books on distilling, whiskey, ice molds, and more. And off to one side, there's a little room decked out with what looks like a miniature science lab.
So can you describe what we're looking at?
Right now we're working on a spirit that uses some beets. We made a beet vodka previously. So we're trying to adapt that to the mixology crowd down in New York City. So
this is Matt Power. He describes himself as a kind of botanical chemist. While we were there, he got out what he called the baby bird dropper, stood on a stool, and squeezed a couple drops of a light amber liquid onto my tongue.
Mm-hmm. Okay, what do you think?
Oh, wow. Ooh.
Familiar?
It's like drinking perfumes.
That's just it in a lot of cases. This is actually the non-volatile fraction of a ginger infusion. So we distill off all...
On the other side of the lab is a long building that houses the great big copper still they use to make their products. It looks like something out of a steampunk movie, and the room smells like fermenting apples.
Oh my god, it smells like growing
right
fermenting
now,
yeah. Things.
Wow. As it turns out, it's brandy season. Distiller Jamie Oakes explained why it looks so complicated.
But for us, we wanted something that we call a kind of a Swiss Army knife of stills. So we're able to do a lot of different things, such as brandy now, whiskey, gin, and then this tall 23-foot column is our vodka tower, or our rectifying column. So we're actually...
From one perspective, this isn't exactly your mom-and-pop distillery. Founder Stephen Grass is the man behind Sailor Jerry Rum and Hendrick's Gin. On the other hand, what they do here is definitely craft. The folks at Tamworth Distillery pride themselves on using botanicals sourced from their on-site garden. They've purchased local mushrooms and fruit for a blueberry cordial they created. The apples they're using for this season's brandies all came from Carter Hill Orchard in Concord. And all of their spirits are distilled from local grain that they mill themselves, which, as operations manager David Grass, Stephen's brother, tells me is rare.
And the distinction is that, you know, when you talk about craft brewing, everybody would expect that that craft brewer made his own liquid. But in the liquor business, it's totally different.
So to answer Jonathan's question about local liquor and what it takes to get on the shelf here in New Hampshire, Virginia sat down with David Grass, along with Jillian Anderson from sales, and Lulu Henley, the distillery's events coordinator.
You're one of few liquor producers here in New Hampshire, right?
Yeah, we're, I think, one of six in the state.
So how have you navigated the liquor laws here? Was it a steep learning curve?
Actually, the New Hampshire Liquor Commission has been very supportive for someone who didn't know anything about manufacturing liquor in the state. From the enforcement division to sales and marketing, they've been very, very helpful in getting us started and helping us navigate through the process of getting our products listed on in their stores. Normally, what would happen is if we were an out-of-state manufacturer, we would have to go through a distributor or a broker. But because we are a in-state manufacturer, we're allowed to distribute directly to the Liquor Commission. There's a one-time buy where they buy it one time and they'll see how it does. They'll put it in a small number of stores to see how, kind of a test market to see how it works out. Typically, they put them into the highway stores because they get a lot of traffic in those stores. But we were able to work with them and give input on where we would like to see our products placed so that we can, you know, sell them into a geographic area that makes sense for us.
So where are your best-selling stores now?
I think the highway stores.
So the 93 corridor.
Yeah, that's
but
a good store.
Also local to us. Yeah. I mean, really, we've gotten so much support. And possibly that's because I spent a lot of time when I first got out doing sales, keeping it close to home in the Conway area and Center Harbor and Meredith in the Lakes region, because that was, you know, I grew up in the hospitality industry, and so it was a lot of connections I kind of had and knew, and it's been fantastic. And so, and then Portsmouth is starting to show a lot of greatness for us as well.
So do you have dedicated shelf space? Is there dedicated shelf space for local liquor in New Hampshire?
Yeah, we have dedicated shelf space for some of our products. We've also worked with some of the local managers to build a New Hampshire made section for local spirits, and all of the other liquor manufacturers in the state are represented on that shelf too.
But not having a distributor, does that mean when they run low, like you actually have to drive there and deliver?
No, we're not legally allowed to do that. I think beer and wine is different. They could do that in the state of New Hampshire. Liquors run a little bit differently. So we then replenish the stash in the warehouses in the state of New Hampshire, so basically the Concord warehouse, and then they distribute it out to the stores on their trucks. Mm-hmm.
What can you do that a big national or international brand can't, or and vice versa? What can they do?
We can hand mill all of our grains. We can hand mill all of our grains, which is just a really cool thing.
What difference does that make?
Oh gosh, I'll let Lulu speak to that.
Okay, so part of what we are able to do here is be scratch made, which involves milling all of our own grains. What is common practice in the majority of distilleries right now is you will buy your base spirit or your neutral grain spirit in bulk from a big rectifier. There are a few in this part of the continent that are the main suppliers. You'll buy that, you'll ship it in. You'll run it through your still, infuse it, bottle it, put your label on it. There you go. But we source all the grains whole and then mill them in a tiny little mill right here. Jamie gets really dusty on those days. And then also part of the benefit of our smallness is that we're able to be experimental. We're able to be inconsistent in a good way. Because if you think, if you wanna, if you taste Jack Daniels in a bar and then you go to the liquor store and you buy Jack Daniels, you want it to taste exactly the same. But because we are small and craft, it's able to be a bit more like making wine, really. Exactly. Like the terroir matters. The sourcing of our ingredients matters. The season does play a role in what the final product is. Certainly, it's apple season right now, and our brandies are always going to be slightly unique because one year it'll be dry, one year it'll be wet. And that actually is tasteable in the finished product, which is very exciting. I mean, the fact that our distillers have the freedom to be constantly developing, constantly evolving, and constantly improving is very special.
How about disadvantages, though? Like, how are ways that, you know, it's tough to compete in this market?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's a lot of products on the shelves. And so, you know, we're growing our brands organically, locally, and people that appreciate locally made products are loyal to us and buying our products. But definitely true. There's a lot of products that are available. It's a very competitive market or space to be in.
Well, I wonder about that. I mean, I know they're your biggest customer, so you're not going to say anything against the Liquor Commission, but what would you change about how the rules and regulations work for your business?
It would be nice to allow us to sell directly to some of the on-premise accounts. Like, for example, if we had a very small batch of raspberry cordial that we wanted to share with a few unique on-premise accounts, it would be nice to be able to sell it directly to restaurants and taverns, bars. But it's really not that hard to do it also through the Liquor Commission. They have ways that allow us to ship it in into what's called a bailment account that we're not charged for, and then the customers can buy it through there. But there are some strings for them to have to go through that process. So it would make it a little easier if we could do that.
So Matt said downstairs something about he was mixing up some of these cordials for the New York City crowd. So, right. I mean, like, how would those bottles get into a New York City bar? Would somebody have to come to New Hampshire and buy them from
No, we have to sell them in bulk, bottled, to a distributor in New York who then distributes to those on-premise accounts. Same thing in Boston. And it would be the same thing here if we wanted to release one of those drink modifiers. If it was the roasted chicory blue lion product, we could sell it directly into the state, and they would do the same thing.
I saw the Blue Lion local chicory. First of all, I thought it might be Chicorua instead of chicory. But, I mean, alcohol is regional. You have your Champagne from Champagne and Kentucky bourbon, like where you got your mills. And do we have any regional liquor traditions in New Hampshire?
We're working on it.
You're creating the regional liquor tradition.
Yeah, I would say, well, Applejack, apple brandy, cider, that has its deepest roots in certain New England history of drinking. Johnny Appleseed was not planting apple trees for apple pie. He was planting them for drinking. We just released a Pommeau that we are calling a New England. Is it a New England or a New Hampshire Pommeau?
Pommeau, I don't know what that is.
Pommeau, French apple water. It is a blend of apple brandy and apple cider aged together in a bourbon barrel. And all of the apples came from Carter Hill Orchard outside of Concord, including some heirloom Baldwin apples, which are like an almost extinct strain of apple. So we took that as a sign that we could call it a New Hampshire Pommeau. And then, yeah, well, Jill, you were talking a little while ago about other distilleries trying to start a new categorization of whiskey called the New York Rye. So there are rumblings of those shifts happening already.
Where do you think New Hampshire is in this movement compared to the rest of the country? I mean, there's
coming
a
up.
It's coming up in the movement. I think a lot of great things are coming out of New Hampshire, and we're going to start seeing more and more of it.
Yeah. Craft distilling is, you know, exploding. You know, it's growing across the whole country, just following the craft beer movement. We are growing. We are adding jobs. We are connected to the local agriculture, and which helps the whole community or the and the state as a whole.
What is success to you here?
Well, we sell pretty much everything we make, and what's success is to see, you know, young people coming in and finding careers and trades in this business and watching it grow is success.
I think also from a success standpoint, the idea that we are giving people this knowledge on what it means to be scratch made. Yeah. And so I love the fact that, like, the more I'm out there, the more people kind of, it's like reading a label, right? You know, non-GMO and organic and craft or whatever it is. It's really getting people to know that that exists in distilling as well. And it's a movement we really want to strive for and see people become more aware of, that they look at their bottles and see that it's, you know, made with local grains and bottled on site. And
distilled and bottled by means that it was made by that facility. If it says produced and bottled by, it means that it wasn't. It means that it was made somewhere far away and just bottled, just repackaged.
And on my end, it is very personal what David said about young people coming in, starting careers, starting trades. I am one of those people. Tamworth is my hometown. Went to school out of state and was not adamantly opposed to moving back to New Hampshire, but it was just not on my radar. I just assumed that I wouldn't. And then this place has appeared, you know, it's and it's really great. We are a very small team. We're about seven people. We're almost all from New Hampshire. And it's very exciting to see a sort of 20s and 30s community returning to the area. But it's not removed. It's not separate. It's like, it's not a brand new wave of trendy things just kind of plopped on top of what was here before. It's very much integrated into the community that Tamworth always had, which is a community of farmers and makers and creative people. And so it could have gone very differently to have a large industrial, well, large comparatively speaking, industrial enterprise come into a town. We've seen it happen over and over again and seen the results be not so great from a culture standpoint. And Tamworth Distilling is an exception to that, for sure. I mean, it's been an opening of doors rather than a shutting down of styles.
Our culture.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
And it's fun to watch people taste good tasting spirits. It's a lot of fun.
That was David Grass, Operations Manager, Jillian Anderson, Sales and Hospitality, and Lulu Henley, Events Coordinator, all for Tamworth Distilling. You can see some pictures of their operations at wordofmouthradio.org. And of course, they had suggestion number two for our Granite State Cocktail Challenge.
Have you developed a signature New Hampshire cocktail, do you think?
Well, we did just discover a cocktail pairing or a mixing pairing that we're calling the Chinook, which is applicable for a few reasons. The Chinook, the Chinook is a breed of dog that was first bred in Wanalancet, New Hampshire. So then we just produced an aquavit, which is a sort of Scandinavian, Norwegian, après-ski, warming up kind of spirit, perfect for this time of year. And we found that mixed with this one particular bitter citrus soda made by San Pellegrino called Chinotto, C-H-I-N, is delicious. And you can call it the Chinook. And I think that is very Tamworth. That's very perfect.
Guys, thank you so much.
Oh, good. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for coming up.
This is Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio. Your questions answered, your state explored. I'm Taylor Quimby, stepping in for Virginia Prescott. And today, we're tackling an only in New Hampshire topic that asks, why are liquor laws so weird in New Hampshire? To get some more specific areas of investigation, we reached out to you on Facebook, and one of the questions we received was this one.
Hi, this is Sarah from Concord, and I would love to know how much of our alcohol revenue goes to supporting social services like education, public education, addiction counseling, things like that. Thanks.
Well, most of the revenue collected by the Liquor Commission from sales and licensing fees goes to the general fund. So just like you can't say exactly what percentage of your federal income taxes are being spent on, say, defense, you can't specifically say how much liquor revenue goes into education as a general spending area. Addiction counseling is a slightly different story, though. Paige Sutherland is a reporter here at NHPR, and earlier this year she did a story that broke down the costs and benefits of New Hampshire's liquor sales. Here she is, speaking with Virginia Prescott.
Well, Paige, thanks so much for speaking with me.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
So what do we know about alcohol consumption in New Hampshire, especially compared to other states?
Yeah, so historically, New Hampshire has always ranked high in several federal reports. I mean, even a report just in April, we ranked the highest state in the country to consume the most alcohol. There was a breakdown of ages 12 and older. 64% drank on a monthly basis. That was the highest in the country. And a lot of New England states, though, also fell right around that range as well, though.
Is there a per capita rating on drinking?
Yeah, so it's about 4.72 gallons per capita, which is about double what is consumed nationally.
Wow. Any explanations as to why New Hampshire is such a heavy drinking state?
I think there's several reasons. I mean, there have been some reports where, you know, we're not a religious state. Religious states, you know, don't consume as much given obviously
dry counties.
Yeah, given obviously the religious background. Also, we're a colder state. There's less sunlight. Those are good reasons to drink sometimes in the winter. As well, the biggest really thing about why New Hampshire we drink so much is it's marketed so well. We are a state that does not have a sales tax, does not have an income tax. We need to pay the bills somehow, and how we pay that bills, at least part of it, is through taxing alcohol.
So how much does the state make from its state-run liquor stores?
So every year it goes up. I mean, the last year, 2016, we made $195 million. And that's just in profits that we made. We sold $685 million worth of alcohol. And it's crazy. We make millions and millions of alcohol, and we're constantly building our capacity. Since we're a liquor control state, we own the liquor stores. We had 10 new liquor stores in the state in the past couple years.
Wow. How about alcoholism and funding programs for alcoholism?
So that has been tricky. In 2000, the legislature decided that, hey, alcoholism is a problem. We are going to take some responsibility for this. We are a state that makes money off marketing and selling alcohol. So we're going to make this fund to curb addiction that comes of alcohol. So they created this fund to take 5% of liquor sales and put it towards addiction services. That's only been fully funded once since 2000.
What do you mean that full amount is not being spent or none of it is?
The full amount. So the legislature said 5% of liquor sales. Only once has that been fully funded. And for the most part, it's been around 1.5, 1.7% this last legislative session. The governor signed a bill making it to 3.4%. So still, it's never, besides once, reached that targeted 5%, and that shortfall is millions of dollars.
So what's the reason for that? I mean, we're looking at an opioid crisis right now. Addiction is clearly a problem.
The big reason is money. You know, we are a state that's fiscally conservative. We don't have a lot of taxes, as you know. And so we make money, as you saw, millions and millions of dollars of alcohol. We want to use that to pay other bills.
What would this alcohol fund, as it's known as, what does it actually pay for?
So the common misconception is that it's just for alcohol. But as you know, in treatment, they don't decipher between alcoholism, you know, cocaine, heroin issues. It goes to all treatment. So it's prevention, treatment when it comes to the substance abuse addiction side in general. So it's not just targeted at alcohol. And a big thing to mention as well is that this comes at a cost when you don't when you market alcohol and rely on its revenue and don't fund these treatment centers, is that it's costing the state about $1 billion a year in several different facets. That's lost productivity in the workforce, absenteeism, That's, you know, court fees related to alcohol-related crimes. That's medical bills related to alcohol-related problems. So it really racks up a big bill when it comes to selling alcohol and people getting addicted.
So even with the governor signing this bill to spend 3.5%, there are always going to be fiscal problems, always shortfalls to make up. How likely is it that that money will actually go towards treating or preventing alcoholism?
So since 2000, there have been pushes mostly from Democrats to make this fund the 5% that it was intended by the state legislature. And as you know, it hasn't been that successful. This upcoming session, there's two bills. One's a constitutional amendment to make this 5% mandatory, that we will have to fund that no matter what. But we'll see. I mean, again, we have the same governor in office, the same majority Republican, and they only got it to 3.4%. They wanted that 5%. So we'll see if that happens.
Well, Paige, thank you so much for your reporting on this.
Yeah, well, thanks for having me.
That was Virginia Prescott and NHPR's Paige Sutherland. You can find a link to Paige's article. There's some great graphics there as well at wordofmouthradio.org. As we've learned throughout this show, navigating liquor laws is really complicated. Many date back to Prohibition and are so old it's hard to find out what they really are. So to answer a few rapid-fire questions that we still had at this point, here again is Joseph Malika, chairman of the New Hampshire Liquor Commission.
Is it true that musicians, performers, that they can't drink while they're doing those things on stage at a pub or a bar or something like that?
That's true. And it is true because they are considered to be an employee. They're being paid by the licensee, so they are considered an employee of the licensee.
I've definitely got a comped drink here or there, and I won't rat anybody out, but I heard that it is illegal to give out a free drink at a bar pretty much under any circumstance.
It is, and the main reason behind that is for the taxation of the alcohol and the accountability of the alcohol. Licensees are accountable for the alcohol that they purchase.
So a lot of people talk about sort of the highway liquor store because that's like another sort of New Hampshire thing. Somebody asked whether or not that leads to more drunk driving or whether or not there are sort of statistics on how that impacts drinking here.
And one of the things we do is we don't sample in any of our highway stores. This is the way I always look at it. No matter where you go, you're going to drive to a liquor store, whether it's on the highway or whether it's on a back road in a town.
But do people come from Canada to go to our liquor stores?
Absolutely.
Yeah?
Yeah. We do a lot of Canadian business, especially in the summer. The laws are, some are very old, some are layered with change and statutory regulation. So, I mean, we hear things all the time and we look into it and say, no, absolutely, that isn't the way it is. This is the way it is. And people are, you know, we're constantly educating ourselves and consumers as to what actually you can do and you cannot do according to the law. They're liquor laws. I mean, you know, they're wroth with change, so.
Joseph Malika, chairman of the New Hampshire Liquor Commission there. And with that, it is time for our third and final drink recipe for the show. This one was hatched by NHPR's own Nick Capodice. His is a mocktail, no booze required, and it is called The Road Not Taken. And to begin the mixing process, you'll have to run outside.
All right. We gotta find some fresh snow. Untrodden. It's part of the poetry of the whole thing.
Nick is holding a mason jar, which is split in the center by a cardboard divider. He scoops up some snow into one side of the jar. Then we run back into the building because it is super cold outside.
Cold. Good gravy!
Are you ready for this?
Yeah, so this is my take on a Robert Frost cocktail. So there's snow on one side and liquid goes on the other side. Now you know why there's a thing in the middle, right? Because good fences make good neighbors.
Oh boy.
Just got like 10 more of these.
The recipe goes like this. Start with a jigger of maple syrup.
So on top of the maple syrup, you want to float another part of milk.
Then float another part of raspberry syrup on top of the milk.
And then on the top of the raspberry cordial, just for a little bit of effervescence, a soupçon of birch beer from bending birches. Robert Frost.
The liquid at this point is creeping up the snow, turning it a bright pink color.
Wait, say that again. So this is your third Robert Frost pun.
Yes, the snowy side is the road less traveled. And it has made all the difference.
When you're ready, pull out the cardboard, mix it up, and take a sip.
It's really good. Here, try it.
Mmm. Whoa.
Yeah.
Whoa, it's like something you would get at a carnival. It's very festive.
Now, if this was going to be if there was an alcoholic variation, what would you do differently?
I would replace the maple syrup with a coffee liqueur, like a Kahlua or something like that, and the milk I'd replace with Bailey's floating on top.
It's very sweet. Yeah, no, that's very good. That's good.
Okay, so that is our third and final cocktail. Vote for your favorite on Twitter. We don't expect you to try them all, so feel free to vote based on the name. They are the Manhattan, the Chinook, and the Road Less Traveled. Three Granite State cocktails to warm your bellies in the new year. Thanks so much for listening to the show, and a very special thank you to EJ Powers and Mary Searles, who helped me do some research. This episode was produced by me, with Virginia Prescott, Jimmy Gutierrez, Hannah McCarthy, Ben Henry, and Justine Paradise. Maureen McMurray is director of Catching Stomach Bugs Just Before the Holidays. Sorry, Maureen. Music in this episode from Poddington Bear and Blue Dot Sessions. Drink responsibly if you drink, drive safe regardless, and from all of us here at Word of Mouth, have a happy new year and a wonderful 2018. Word of Mouth is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio.